morning and welcome to an episode of the Litigation Psychology Podcast. I am here, Ava Hernandez, with Dr. Bill Kanaski. I'm very excited to be here. It is my first time hosting, and today Bill is my guest.
Yeah, your worst guest. Boy, you picked a difficult guest to start off your podcasting hosting career.
Really starting off strong here. Just so I went 100% dive into the deep end. Well, I'm very excited to be here because we're kicking off our little series here we've got going on, which is just get to know your CSI consultants, right? I think we all talk a lot about, you know, our philosophy, but we don't talk about ourselves personally sometimes. And I think in this business, it's kind of nice to know a little bit about the people that you're working with. And I know there's questions I've never had a chance to ask you, Bill. So I'm excited to ask you some of these myself.
I'm an open book, but be careful what you ask for, I guess, right?
Hey, listen, I understand and I appreciate anything, right? So I'm kind of curious to hear about, how did you first get into this industry? How did you first hear about the litigation consulting and litigation psychology world?
Yeah, this is a great story. I kind of found it by accident, but I was looking for something. So I was at the University of Florida. I was in the middle of my PhD program in psychology, and everything was going fantastic. And as I started to develop in the field of psychology and my training and getting my master's and my PhD right behind it, I started to notice something I became a little uneasy with, is that younger professors that were within their first 5 years and getting started in their career. I mean, these were the people I was aspiring to be in, to follow in their footsteps. And something very concerning that I noticed about this group of younger professors, they were very unhealthy. They were miserable. They were not sleeping well. They were not eating right. They were not, they were extraordinarily stressed out. And through interviewing them and getting to know them, I learned that the tenure track system at an academic health science center was brutal. Mm-hmm. I also learned that there was a lot of politics involved, and I don't do that shit. A lot of ass kissing involved. I certainly don't do that shit. And I started to kind of second guess my career choice. I was like, you know, do I really want to go through this? And if I get to this point, you know, I don't want to be like them. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I very quietly said, you know, I may have to consider some other options here. So I just started to research on my own time. And I looked very strongly into sports psychology because I'm big in the sports. And I think there's a huge, huge mental component. I mean, every professional golfer has their own personal sports psychologist. Mm-hmm. So many professional athletes do, every college sports program. I mean, that I found that to be pretty damn cool, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm looking at that going, well, yeah, I could do that, but now I have to get even, I'm not in a sports psychology program. I'm in a clinical program. Like, right. I would have to go get even more. Like, do I really want to, you know, going to college for 10 years is tough enough. Do I want to go for 12?
Right.
Or maybe even 13. I don't know about that. So I started to look into other options for clinical psychologists. And I came across an article. It was in the APA, American Psychological Association, published an article around the year 2000 on, it was called like Alternative Careers for Clinical Psychologists. Like, hey, this is pretty interesting. There's like 20 different careers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, people being clinical psychologists in the military and then in the private sector at companies, right? And a lot of it was really cool. And the moment I started, I'm like something, a one-off for me would be, because my personality and my level of intensity just was not gonna mix in well with the Academic Health Science Center. Mm-hmm. And there was an article from it, and I forget who it is. I forget her name. And it was a trial consultant. God, I wish I remember her name. I don't remember. And I read it and I'm like, oh, wow. So I just started researching her. And the more I read about trial consulting, the more excited I got. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this is like, I could fit into this world. It's less, you know, it's not really political. It's based on competence. It's based on work ethic. And it just seems to be something really, really, really cool. And that's what I like. I like a lot of change. I like constant dynamics. And that's what the field seemed to be. You know, when you're treating a patient for depression and you're on session 14, yeah, it's a really important job. It's just not extraordinarily dynamic. Or if you're doing research for NIH, it's just my personality didn't fit that. And so I called, I just, you know, and this, I tell my kids this, I'm like, if you want to learn about it, pick up the goddamn phone. Pick up the phone. And so what I did is I picked up the phone. I just randomly started calling consultants. This is 20 years ago, 21 years ago. More than that, Jesus, because it was like 22. This is, yeah, so we're talking like the year 2000, right? 2001. And I started calling people. And it's amazing. If you just call somebody, like if somebody called my phone right now and said, hey, I'm a PhD student at a major university. I've read all about you and your articles. I've seen you on LinkedIn. Like, can I talk to you about this field? I'd be like, absolutely. And that's exactly what happened. So I talked to like four or five people in the industry that have been well established. And after talking to them, I was completely sold that this was the life for me. And that's how it all got started. Now, to tell my professors, I'm not following in your footsteps. That did not go over well at the University of Florida.
Yeah.
Clinical psychology department, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, when I came home one day and said, honey, we got to talk. Remember that plan that you've been hanging on to? And we, you know, yeah, I've decided to change the plan. So that was kind of a tough discussion, but she has stood by my side the entire time. And believed in me and said, hey, I love you. I trust your judgment. Mm-hmm. Don't make any. And let me tell you what, this was not a irrational, emotional, amygdala hijack, emotional purchase decision. Mm-hmm. I thought long and hard before I made that decision. It turned out to be one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life.
It's really incredible to hear. And I think it's very interesting because I kind of had the opposite experience where I was so involved in the legal world before I even went to grad school or, you know, kind of dipped my hand into clinical psychology, and you had the opposite. So was it kind of a culture shock for you in this industry? It's very different than a lot of other industries, and it's obviously quite different than academia. Was there a shock for you? How was that transition?
It was opposite. So I think when I started in the PhD program and got surrounded by clinicians and that was the culture shock for me. Cause I was like, God, I don't blend in. I'm the black sheep of this group. Like, I don't blend in well.
Yeah.
I'm high intensity.
Yeah.
I curse a lot.
God bless.
I run circles. I don't bullshit. I don't brown nose. I don't ass kiss. And that was a big part of that system. I'm like, I ain't doing that shit.
Right.
That was the culture shock. Like, God, I'm never really going to blend in here. Mm-hmm. Oh, back to the first part of the story. The straw that broke the camel's back was when it was summertime. We had just had my wife and I just had our first son. So I'm in graduate school getting a PhD, just had a baby. I'm on Medicaid. We're on food stamps. And I'm running circles around my classmates. I'm just killing them because that's what I do. I'm very, very competitive, and I want to be number one. And that's what I was doing in grad school. I was way ahead of the game. So I went to my supervisors, right, faculty, and I said, listen, like, I'm starving. My baby needs milk, and we need like in the summertime, like, is there a part-time job I can do around here? They said, yeah. And it was not what I wanted to hear. It was, we need help in the billing office in our psychology clinic. I go, I have any training in accounting. It's not going to work. They're like, no. You need to review the bills to make sure everything's coded correctly. Right. In 1 hour of therapy, does that match the code? Okay. Now we can send the bill. Mm-hmm. So it's actually important. It's going to be a very good experience for you for your future. And I'm rolling my eyes going, shit, what is it pay? And they told me what it paid. I'm like, well, okay, whatever. It was a terrible, horrible, terrible job, Ava. Horrible. Imagine working in CSI's billing department. By the way, the best people we have in the company. Yeah. I could never do what they do. I'd be done, right? I shoot myself in the face. But it's a really, really important job that when you're having bills go out to your clients or your patients or the insurance, they have to be accurate. That's really, really important. So hats off to the CSI billing department. They play a crucial role in my life and your life. But that was the position I was in. And it was terrible. It was boring. It was horrible. But this is the number one lesson I found. An insurance company sent a letter back because I had sent out a bill. I was like, okay, neuropsych consult. You know, it was like $3,500. Yep, approved. Okay, go. I sent out the bill. They sent a letter back. And I opened up the letter and it said, we're paying $700 because that's what we pay for neuropsych consults. I went, whoa, 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 whoa. $3,500, $700. This is bullshit. So I walk down the hall with this letter. I go to the head of the psychology clinic. I'm like, this is really messed up. And he looked at me, rolled his eyes and said, welcome to clinical psychology, Bill. At Ava, at that point, I'm like, get me the out of here. I'm like, no, no. Then I ran home to my wife. I'm like, no, no, no. I go, look at just what happened. She's like, yeah, that ain't going to work. I go, no, 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 no. No. So I find another reason this is such a great is I find that the value of what I do,
yes,
is compensated the right way. Whereas in the traditional healthcare, you know, system and academia, it's really, really not.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a similar background to you. I have, you know, my master's in clinical psychology and you have your PhD in clinical psychology, which is, you know, in the umbrella of the different kinds of psychological of viewpoints. It's kind of specific, right? It's a way of looking at people at a very individual level, looking at personality and the way in which their personality interacts with their environment and the way that people are sort of stuck within a system, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very holistic way of viewing the person, which is different in a lot of ways than the legal world and litigation views the people that are caught up in everything that's going on. How do you reconcile that? That's something I'm still working on reconciling myself, and something that maybe does it even need to be reconciled? Can we bring a little bit of both perspectives there? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think one of the main things that you and I and Dr. Wood and the rest of our team that we bring to this process, particularly in the witness preparation, witness training process, yeah, is that our ability to see the whole person.
Right.
Whereas a trial attorney, if I just got off the phone with a trial attorney who's a really he's a good friend. He's a great, fantastic attorney. We've worked together a lot. And he said, he's like, I cannot see people like you see people. I cannot do it. And yeah, the things that you find, I would have never, it blows me away that you can do that. And yeah, so that's why, you know, our experience, being trained and having experience and clinically trained to see the whole person, is huge. With our ability to connect with witnesses, to assess witnesses' strengths and weaknesses. I don't like to say that's a clinical process because it's not a clinical environment. It's a legal environment. But I think those clinical skills and knowing what to look for, knowing the questions to ask, seeing where vulnerabilities are at, I think it's a huge value that we bring to the table for our clients, particularly the trial attorneys, so that they're seeing their witness accurately. You know, I do a lot of public speaking. I can't tell you how many times an attorney has come up to me after a speech and said, I worked with this witness for 3 days and they were great. Everything was going well. And then they went to deposition and nuclear bomb.
Right.
They abandoned everything. And they admitted that I wasn't able to see and perceive their vulnerabilities.
Right.
Like someone that you can. So I think this is a really good fit for us because of those types of skills that can help. And a lot of, you know, there are some attorneys that are threatened by us, right? But they really shouldn't be. I think that's ridiculous, actually, because what we bring is an extra skill set to help them accomplish their goal. Mm-hmm. Their goal is to win. Their goal is to have effective testimony. And we can help, we can expedite that, we can do that, help them do that in a much more effective way. And with the vast majority of clients, you know, that's deeply valued. There's still a couple out there that are a little bent out of shape. You know, attorneys, if you're control freaks, you know, let it go, please.
Yeah.
Let it go, because we're, you know, we're not here to, certainly not here to replace anything you do. You know, I have read probably thousands of like motions for summary judgment in my career. Right. I can't, there's no way I'm going to write one. I'm not taking over. Trust me. I don't want to do anything you're doing. I'll stick to psychology. You stick to law, but you have to understand a massive part of litigation is psychological. And the moment you figure that out and are able to understand the weaponry that you have, you're going to be in a much better position as a trial attorney and have really good things happen.
Right. And, you know, I had a few witness trainings this week, Bill, and I wanted to hear your thoughts if you've ever had this experience of, you know, as it, with training from clinical psychology, we learn a lot about ethics, right? We learn a lot about the ethics of caring for the whole person, the ethics of, you know, if I'm treating a patient or a client, who's my priority? Is it myself? Is it the patient? Is it the client? Right. Kind of the ethics of all of that. And in witness training, sometimes the ethics of things are complex, right? Because yeah, ethically you want to be there and provide for this person, right, who's struggling. You also were hired, right, by a client or by the attorney to kind of help them testify in a way that's amenable to the case, right? Our job sometimes also consists of going in and saying, hey, you kind of got a problem with your case, right? And everyone was a little bit too uncomfortable to kind of face it, right? Until you have maybe a neutral third party perspective. Yeah. How do you square all those different kind of ethical considerations when you're dealing with, you're there for this individual who's also sitting within a larger, broader kind of system of this case, who's sitting within a larger, broader system of the claims industry, et cetera, right? It's complex.
Yeah, it is. It is complex. And there are several ethical issues, several of them, and they pop up frequently. You know, one is, you know, a trial attorney or a claims manager, you know, may really, really want a witness to testify in a certain way.
Right.
And the witness resists because that's not how they feel.
Right.
Right. And there's a conflict. There's a conflict there.
Right.
And if you have a witness that, you know, is, and it's not like I've never seen in 21 years a trial attorney or a claims manager tell a witness you need to lie. Right. No, 100%. Never.
Right.
But there's certainly some shaping of behavior and answers, sometimes to the point where the witness is uncomfortable, and that creates a conflict, and you can't make a witness not say something or say something that's inaccurate because it helps your case, even though it would really help your case if they had a different viewpoint of it. And that's a struggle sometimes. So oftentimes we'll be working, like, for example, we were working with a truck driver about 2 weeks ago, and he said something during the prep that was like a bombshell that the client wasn't expecting. The trial attorney wasn't expecting, and the trial attorney was like, you can't say that. Like, do not say that during the dep. And my response to that was, well, what if he's asked?
Right.
What if he is asked? And that puts the witness into a terrible position. Like, well, what do I do? I don't want to lie. I don't want to get in trouble. Like, I don't want to lie, but I don't want to let down the trial attorney. But I also don't want to get fired from my job. And so, you know, what the attorneys and the clients have to understand is, you know, there's bad facts in every case.
Yep.
And you got to own them. Yep. You got to own them, right? We've talked about pivoting and pivoting. That doesn't freaking work. But you got to own them, because if a witness tries to dance around something, it's never going to work out. It's only going to make things worse. And I think it's unethical to put a witness in that position rather than saying, no, you tell the truth. right? Versus, let's kind of sugarcoat it this way. It's always going to blow up in your face. And I do see a problem with that. I also say an ethical, this is a great question, by the way, because this never comes up, the whole ethical part of this.
Yeah.
I've seen certain witnesses be asked to do things they're completely incapable of.
Yes. My God, yes.
And the attorney gets frustrated. And then I'm looking at the attorney. I'm like, you cannot squeeze water out of a rock. Stop it. We have a different witness talk about this. I know you deeply desire this witness. You're right. Being an expert and what you're right, like, they're not an expert.
Right.
And they either don't have the knowledge or they don't have the cognitive or the emotional capacity and capability to do what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to come to grips with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen a lot of terrible testimony. You've seen a lot of terrible testimony. Usually when you and I get called on a case before trial and we have not worked with these witnesses before deposition, they send us to dep and it's like, oh my gosh, what? Like, this is a disaster. And many of times that's another issue, is that the witness was being asked to do things that they could not do and epically failed. I think that's another, ethical, consideration. And then like a final one is you and I have been screaming this from the rooftop. I know you do a talk on this, and I have a paper being formed on this. It's the ethical issues around the mental wellness of the actual witness.
Right.
And that deserves far more consideration, and it does not get enough attention. And when you're an attorney and you're putting a lot of pressure on a witness to perform, and you're not aware because you're not a psychologist, you cannot assess what's going on with them emotionally and mentally. And then that witness goes, and that witness is skipping meals. That witness is not sleeping. That witness is having ruminating thoughts. That witness is not being a good parent or spouse because they're overwhelmed by what you're causing, whether you know it or not.
Yep.
You can really ruin somebody's life quickly.
Yep.
Even to the point of self-harm. Now, in 21 years of this, I've never had a witness in that situation ever commit suicide. That'd be horrible. That would be the worst day of my life. I can tell you that right now. That's never happened. And I would hope the reason it doesn't happen, because I'm assessing these, I'm asking the right questions.
Right.
To try to identify these things. However, I've had several, again, no one asks these questions because they're very uncomfortable questions. I ask them at every session, is I ask them like, hey, not just how are you doing? I'm like, how are you coping with stress?
Right.
And I ask. And I said, listen, this is fully privileged. This is work product. This is attorney-client privilege. I need the truth. And I'm here to help you. And if you need extra help, we'll find you extra help. But I'm like, are you hitting the sauce?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are you smoking the wacky weed? are you doing something even beyond that?
Yeah.
Okay. There's several unhealthy behaviors. Let's get in a different category. That's substance use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Trust me. I know. Mm-hmm. Is a terribly destructive way to cope.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it doesn't work. That's why I don't drink anymore. I don't touch any of that stuff because I do other healthier things. But other questions, right? Are you overeating?
Right.
Are you compulsively shopping or doing something else? Are you gambling? You'd be shocked what witnesses have told me. And then the attorney's sitting there going, holy shit.
Right.
I didn't know I was dealing with this. I'm like, well, number one, you didn't ask. Number two, you don't know how to ask. This is what people do when their stress levels go through the roof.
Right.
Okay. Now, we would love them to be going to the gym 5 to 7 days a week like I do, right? We would love them to be reading self-help materials. We'd love them to be going to maybe a support group. Or if they're spiritual, be going to their spiritual group, whether it be church or synagogue or temple or whatever it is. Okay. There are many, many healthy ways to cope, which is where I want to push the witnesses to go and even help them you know, find those things when necessary. But there's a huge ethical component of witness wellness.
Right.
There, I just made up a term. Witness wellness, particularly mentally health, but there's also a physical component, because if they're not exercising and if they're, you know, shoving food, you know, in their face to cope with stress, and they're not sleeping well, and now you have all these physical side effects as well. Mm-hmm. You know, back to the substance use, you know, the entire country, there's a pain, I mean, the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. in fact, okay. Witnesses do that. So there's a lot of potential trouble out there, and right. It's a massive ethical component to the litigation that I think the trial attorney does, but also should struggle with.
Right.
And it's one of the layers of help and protection that we can bring to the table to make sure that part is actually addressed the right way. Mm-hmm. It's something that is certainly not discussed enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. And I think back to what you were saying earlier when you were like, listen, attorneys, we're not trying to take your jobs, right? It's because it's, I'm with you. I also don't want to write a motion for summary judgment. I don't want to do that.
I don't. Stuff.
No, thank you. I've drafted a couple of those. I'm good, you know? And I what we want to do is be here in the nitty gritty, in the pain and the complexity of someone who's just genuinely struggling on a human psychological level, because that's an enormous part of this. And of course, your risk factors for having depressive episodes, for having manic episodes, for having major anxiety, for dealing with substance use, your risk factors for all of that go up exponentially, right? When you're involved in litigation, which is inherently such a stressful thing.
Yeah, so let's just make this clear. Like, the general population has massive struggles with everything we talked about.
Right.
The general population. How do you think people involved in litigation are doing? Oh God, it multiplies exponentially. Right. It's a massive problem. And you and I are doing everything we can to bring light to it, to address it, to help with intervention,
right,
to help make it better. But I tell you what, it's one of those, again, it's like one of those dirty little secrets no one wants to talk about. Right. And quite frankly, I think trial attorneys, which again, they should be, are very uncomfortable with these topics.
Of course they are, right? Of course.
I mean, I would, if you asked me to go look up case law, me, it's like, I'd be like, what the fuck? I'd be very uncomfortable with that, right?
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I always get asked, do you ever get asked by friends or family for legal advice? I'm like, I'm not an attorney. I don't know. I could go ask somebody for you.
Yep, all the
but,
time.
But, you know, I think this is a very uncomfortable area for trial attorneys. It should be an uncomfortable area, but the trial attorneys need to understand there are qualified people and consultants like us that can help in this regard. And the more you address these issues, it's going to lead to much better outcomes. And you're going to be more ethical in the way you practice.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I tell people all the time, my witnesses, I tell them, the attorneys, they'll say, oh, you know, thank you. I go, stop. It is my genuine privilege. It is my genuine honor to be here with someone when they're having a tough experience. That is genuinely what I love. And I know you feel the same way, Bill. I know that it matters to you. You care. Oh, yeah. You give a shit.
Absolutely.
A whole lot of shits.
Absolutely.
It
absolutely
matters.
I like impacting people's lives.
Yes. So
that's a big,
right.
That's a big part of this. So
huge. Yeah. Well, last question for you, Bill, and thank you so much. This has been a really cool discussion.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. What do you see as kind of the future of the litigation landscape? It seems like in the last few years, even, we're starting to talk a little bit more about mental health and the human holistic parts of all of this. Do you see that becoming bigger in the future? Do you see anything else kind of shifting in the litigation landscape in the next few years?
Unfortunately, I think everything we talked about, the mental health stuff, particularly with the witnesses and stuff, that ain't going away.
Yeah.
That ain't going away. And there's, quite frankly, not enough. I'm going to say this. It may piss a couple of people off. I don't give a shit. There are not enough qualified people to deal with this. Tell you that right now. I can tell you that right now. There's not enough qualified people to deal with it. That problem's not going away. You know, if you need help from us, we're here for you. It's a massive problem that, you know, we'll do what we can on all of our cases and with our clients. But boy, that's a huge, just monumental problem for the industry, which I'm not sure there's an answer for that. But the future of litigation, I think it's pretty crystal clear. The writing on the wall is that this next chapter, quite frankly, I'm terrified. It's the whole AI issue and how that is going to, it's scary. Mm-hmm. How it's going to, and it's going to affect the industry on many different levels. It's certainly going to get its way into the court system. It's certainly going to be used by defense and plaintiff attorneys, maybe a little bit differently. It's going to be used. It's going to be what you're going to see. Give it, I know things go pretty fast. Give it 5 years where you're going to see major lawsuits with the claim being that AI was used inappropriately or ineffectively, mm-hmm. that led to damages of some sort. Mm-hmm. It's going to be just like you have MedMal cases, you're going to have AI cases.
Right.
That's what you're going to have.
All the EMR cases that came out, it's going to be the same thing.
So I think that's kind of where this is it's going. I don't think it's going to get there fast. Like everybody, I mean, I remember, what was it like maybe 6 months ago, every LinkedIn post, right? Like I had to stop following two people on LinkedIn because the only thing they would post about was AI. I'm like, shut up already. Like I get it, but yeah. You know, this is not Skylink right now. It's right. You know, the whole, they're not, it's not going to take over the world in the next six, just relax. Yeah, it is going to get there like everything else got there. But it's just, everybody's like in pure panic attack. And then, you know, 6 months later, no one's even talking about it right now until something else happens. But I think that's kind of where it's going. And I think it's terrifying because there's so many unknowns. You know, I'm a veteran jury psychologist. You ask me right now how jury feels about this stuff. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a long time to figure that. Mm-hmm. To figure that out. And then, you know, how it's using the claims process. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to solve a lot of claims problems. Remember, with anything in life, oftentimes you come up with an intervention to solve a problem, you've just created three more additional problems.
Right.
So, right. And that's, so things may happen downstream that are different problems and new problems now that no one knows about. And so you kind of have to sit back and wait and see how it plays out. So I think that you're going to see a lot of that stuff popping up in addition to the, you know, traditional claims that we see. And anybody that gets on LinkedIn and tells you they know where this is going,
yeah,
they're no.
What crystal ball do they have?
And I appreciate their opinions or whatever.
Right, 100%.
But I don't think I don't think anybody really knows.
Lots of unknowns.
Where it's going. But, you know, it's, I think part of it's exciting too for law firms and for companies and insurance companies and, you know, how things are done. I think AI will probably help create several efficiencies, which will be kind of like a win-win across the board. Then I think there are going to be some other efficiencies that are not good for particularly law firms. If AI can do a lot of that billable work that's traditionally done by a law firm, the law firm is going to have to figure that out. We did a podcast on this where I had three attorneys on. We talked about this and the three attorneys said, yeah, as law firms, we're going to have to figure out probably different billing models, different, yeah, how we have to change. We're going to have to evolve along with technology. And so I think it's doable. That's where I see the future going. But to kind of take a different angle from that, I think the more immediate thing that you're going to see, which has already started, but I think it's going to grow, is going to be the what's steadily growing in litigation that we're seeing claim after claim is the insertion of traumatic brain injury claims. And so that's something that I know the plaintiff's bar is pushing really hard to introduce those claims, regardless of what the evidence looks like, because there is no real, yeah, scientific, there's no blood test for a TBI, right? And so that's been happening for a little while now, but I think that the amount of claims involving TBI are as the plaintiff's bar does their homework, which, by the way, they do a very good job of doing homework, as they continue to do the homework and figure out how juries make decisions on those types of claims, mm-hmm. you're going to start to see an escalation of those claims. That's already started. I think that's a 2 to 3 foot wave. That's going to be a 4 to 6. That's going to be a 9 to 10 foot wave here over the next coming years. So, you know, what we are doing, you and I, Dr. Wood, C. Wood, we have already started to, you know, take a look at this, and it takes time to collect data. And, you know, my goal is to stay ahead of the curve, to get these answers scientifically in a valid, reliable way at the jury level, and then to deliver that information to our clients to help them assess these cases better, help them work up these cases better, and help them try these cases better. I think that's a huge role that we play in the industry, and I want us to be the leader in the and just be cutting edge in that regard.
1000%. I think to help is the goal, and to help feels good. And you know, it's, I love working with the group of people who just genuinely finds a lot of joy in helping. Right. That's,
yeah,
something really,
yeah, that's why I love, that's why I love this job. I told my wife that, I tell my wife this all the time. I tell my two sons, I'm like, I love this job.
Yeah.
And the reason I do is because I'm changing people's lives, whether you like it or not. I am. And when I see these changes and the witnesses, right, I see change again. Here's another topic that doesn't get discussed enough. I love seeing attorneys develop and grow and get better.
Yes.
And no one talks about that either, but man, yeah. I've seen, I mean, again, 21 years in this field, you know, I have some clients I've been working with for 17, 18, 19 years. They've changed, and they have told me, yeah, I'm a better attorney because of you. So that really, really makes me happy. And I like to do that, and just to have a positive impact on the overall field.
Yeah.
So.
Something special, something magic about that. Well, this is really cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. I feel like
absolutely.
There's never enough time to kind of get to the bottom of your philosophy and your background and the way you see things. Thank you for spending a few minutes today. Thank you all, as always, for listening. You can reach out to us on LinkedIn or reach out to us by email. We are here to help, happy to help. And we will catch you on the next one.
See ya.